Okay, and our first case is case number 62512, Las Vegas Development Associates v. District Court. KB Holmes, real party in interest. Mr. Wall for the petitioners. Mr. Weiss for the real party in interest. Mr. Wall, I don't know if you're aware, but we argued a very similar case in Bonk. Last week, Mr. Weiss participated in that unrelated parties to this case, and also I just wanted to let you know that the issues were kind of squared up to the end. Board, so then we set this case as well, so perhaps you might want to look at that oral argument if you haven't done so already. It's Las Vegas Sands versus District Court. It was argued last week. Okay, and in the meantime, we'll go ahead and, I think it was the same judge too, so it's an interesting point. With that in mind, Mr. Wall, you may proceed on behalf of the petitioners. Did you wish to reserve any time?
About 4 minutes.
Very well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Michael Wall, for the record. I have with me Kimberly Barnes and Deborah Deutsch Perez and Patricia Lee, who's also counsel on this case. And we thank you on behalf of our clients for taking the time to hear this today. I hope I'm not at a disadvantage not having heard the other arguments, but your honors are certainly called upon today to perform your highest function. We're not here today to ask you to correct some error. We're here today to ask you to determine what the public policy of the state of Nevada is and should be with respect to probably the oldest and most venerable privilege, one of the most important doctrines of our jurisprudence in this country, in the common law, and particularly in Nevada, and that's the attorney-client privilege. It also impacts the work product privilege, and they overlap in this case, but they're both separate privileges and both are involved in today's question. The defendants interpret the statute this way, and I'm quoting this directly from their answer to the petition, and in fact, this statement is made multiple times in their answer, and this is the statement. The statute is unambiguous. Documents used by a witness to refresh his memory must be produced. There are no exceptions. That's their position. If that is not true, the petition for a writ has to be granted. We suggest that that simply cannot be the law in the state of Nevada with respect to a matter as deeply entrenched and as important as privilege.
Mr. Wall, if you could begin part of your discussion as to why or why not we should look at our statute and take any credence from FRC 612, because this might be somewhat different with our concerns and also as to issues as to waiver.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are differences in the statutes. And the federal rule was adopted, and our statute was adopted shortly before the amendment to that rule. And there are some slight changes in the rule. Defendants argue that because there's a change in the rule, that we have to interpret our statute to have no discretion whatsoever. The entire argument is that there's no discretion in the statute. They argue that that because NRS 50.125 does not say an exception, there can be no exception. But from the beginning, this whole matter has been addressed upside down. The statutes are on their head. Specific statutes generally control over general statutes, and this has always been approached as the discovery statute, NRS 50.125 being the specific statute, and the privilege statute being the general statute, and that's really not the case. NRS 50.125 is a discovery statute of general application. It does not address privilege. The reason it simply doesn't address privilege. Defendants would say because it doesn't address privilege, you have to reach the conclusion that that privilege isn't an exception. But it doesn't address any exception.
Mr. Wall, let me ask you this, and perhaps I went to some of the things we talked about last week and you were here, but I wonder what you'd look and listen to that argument, but some of the concerns the Enron court had. How would, if the document doesn't have to be produced, how would that impede cross-examination of the witness not knowing what documents they referred to refresh their recollection?
Well, the document we're not here to argue that no document that has been shown to a witness ever needs to be produced. And the question is privilege. Any arguments here about whether or not these documents are privileged are misplaced because both the discovery commission and the district judge took the position that these were privileged documents and privilege was waived. So we're talking about privileged documents, and we have the exact same safeguards you would have in any other case. Documents claimed to be privileged are produced to the district court. That's what the district court judge does. Looks at them in camera, makes a determination of which parts are appropriate for discovery and which parts are not appropriate for discovery. That's what district
court does. Well, and Commissioner Bulla, I believe, said that they had to be produced, and the district court agreed. Am I correct on that?
Commissioner Bulla has taken a position, and the position that she takes is that there is a presumption that if you've looked at the document, you have refreshed your recollection, and therefore every document that is looked at has to be produced under the statute because there's no exception. There's no such presumption in the law. This is a presumption that she has created in her mind. The problem and the reason that she's created this presumption is because she's approaching this from the line standpoint. That the term is refreshed recollection is a legal term of art, and when it's used in the statute, it's used with its legal meaning, not with the colloquial meaning that the district court and Commissioner Brewer have given to it. They're not talking about sharpening up your memory or getting your line, your facts straight. Refreshed recollection is a specific situation where once a witness has doesn't have a particular memory. It has been demonstrated that the memory does not exist. Then you show a document which refreshes their recollection. And the reason that it's important is because whatever is refreshing their recollection might be a false memory. And so the other side should have an opportunity to see that. The statute doesn't use the term in a colloquial sense, and we shouldn't either. And that gets me back to Justice Douglas's question, which is the federal rule. The federal rule does have that language in it because they recognized the advisory committee and the Congress recognized the potential problem if you just have a blanket rule, especially a rule before the time of testifying, not at testifying, but before that time, that any document that's looked at can be discovered. Because the rule they're asking you for is, tell your clients, don't prepare for a deposition, or don't show your clients documents, read them to them, because if you read the document, then it would retain its privilege, but if you show it to them, it would not. That is just a form over substance argument. The subcommittee for the federal rule, which we based our rule on, recognized that there was a problem, but that there would be a fishing expedition. So the committee said specifically, the committee intends that nothing in the rule be construed as barring assertion of a privilege with respect to the writings. I think that our statute, which was adopted in the same way, was not a waiver of the privilege rules, because the statutes say NRS 47.020 says the provisions of Chapter 39, the privilege statutes, with respect to privileges, apply to all stages of all proceedings. It couldn't be broader. All stages of all proceedings, and we leave the caveat in there, except where relaxed by a specific statute or rule. And the respondents here have argued, defendants have argued, that NRS 50.124 is that rule that relaxes it. But it doesn't. It would have to be specific. We have a specific statute about privilege, that specific statute has another specific statute about the exceptions to privilege. And we have case law going back decades and centuries about how important the privilege is and applying that privilege. And that allowed us, because there's no specific exception for privilege in the discovery statute, to determine that the discovery statute has no exceptions whatsoever. Mr. Law, legislature intended that. There's no basis for assuming that.
Mr. Law, a couple of questions. You keep referring to the statute as the discovery statute. I'm not sure that I mean it that way. That's not as important to me as the next question that I'm going to ask, and that is, you suggest that to if we were to adopt the reasoning of the respondents in this case, that it would be a wide-open opportunity for everything that an attorney and their client speaks about to be discoverable. I think that's what I hear you say. And yet, my concern is that isn't it also possible that if we go the other way, that we might be encouraging a manner of communication whereby attorneys communicate with their clients, let's just use email as an example, in anticipation of testifying in trial or testifying in deposition, and then can hide behind the use of what they, how they prepped them for their testimony as being privileged. I'm just concerned about both far ends on that spectrum.
Absolutely, that's always been the tension. It's not that, that is not unique to this statute, that's unique to our discovery. It has always been the practice of attorneys to do whatever they can to get anything into a document that will be attorney-client privileged and to try to hide facts in those documents. And courts have always had to deal with that issue of, is this factual and was it made in contemplation of litigation? Is it factual? Should it be discoverable? Or is it not? And district courts review documents routinely in every other context to determine that issue. And there's no reason why they shouldn't be doing the exact same thing in this context. But because the statute doesn't suggest otherwise. It simply says these documents are discoverable, and it's silent on the issue of privilege. If it's silent on the issue of privilege, it's because the legislature did not discuss the issue of privilege with respect to this statute. It's a different one. They say that that the fact that NRS 50.125 is silent on privilege means that there's no exception. But I suggest that if it's silent on privilege, it's because it doesn't address the privilege. It certainly is not a specific statute which makes the exception that is referred to in NRS 47.020, because privilege applies to all stages of all proceedings unless there's a specific statute otherwise. And this isn't that specific statute. It simply doesn't address that issue. So let me get back to Justice Douglas, your question, and that's the federal rules. They say because the federal rule has a specific provision in there that allows for a weighing process, that's an indication that this court simply cannot weigh anything. And I don't think that's a logical fallacy. There's no evidence that the legislature considered this. There is nothing in the statute that supports that conclusion. No evidence has been suggested anywhere that the legislature has intended to entirely overrule privilege in this area.
Isn't the legislature at least trying to look at the statute coming into play fairly silent as to what they intended, the legislative history?
Well, there's nothing specific that we were able to find in the legislative history or anything that's been suggested to this court about that, about this issue, and I believe that that's because this statute, nobody was attempting to overrule privilege when they enacted the statute. Instead, they were addressing the very specific situation.
The sub-argument that you're making, in essence, wanting privilege to be an absolute with no qualifications whatsoever.
That is not the rule that we would suggest.
What would you suggest then?
The rule that we would suggest is that just with, as in every other area, documents be produced to that are claimed to have privilege, be produced to the district court for in-camera inspection, factual matter in the documents have to be produced. In this case, they already have been. We've already produced the document that has all of the factual matters. Privileged communications, on the other hand, should be protected. Work product needs to be protected. Every one of the federal cases, regardless of how you read...
Well, you say it needs to be, but does it have to be? Again, is it absolute or is it a review? As you said, we have an in-camera review of this document by judicial officers. They concluded one thing, we're here arguing another. Tell us why they were incorrect as to the issue you're trying to make as to privilege and work product in this case.
As Your Honor, the mental impressions, opinions, and legal theories of counsel are always protected. If you read all of those federal cases, regardless of how the venue,
you understand that.
Yeah.
But the court in this particular case seemed to find that not in play.
If the district court had made a determination that those things were not in play, and therefore, order of discovery, we have a different issue. The district court has determined that they are in play, and nevertheless, there's an exception. There's no exception to the rule. If there is any exception to the rule, this has to be sent back for the district court to be able to consider that exception.
In this case, didn't the court look at a redacted version as well as the original version and decided that they want the original version used in this case?
The Discovery Commission did that and made that recommendation, and the district court went with it. But because the determination was not the determination was there are no exceptions, and that's why they went the way that they did. This isn't we're not here to argue about this particular piece of this document is factual or non-factual, because that determination was never made, and that's not in the recommendation. What was made was there's no exception.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. We'll give you 3 minutes for rebuttal since we have quite a few questions for you. And let's add 2 minutes, Tracy, to Mr. Bice's time to equalize the time for the parties. Mr. Bice.
May it please the court. Todd Bice on behalf of the real party of interest, KB Holmes. As you had mentioned, Justices, this is a bit of deja vu for me since I was here a week ago on the exact same statute and largely the exact same sort of arguments. As I indicated then, and I will reiterate, the point of NRS 50.125 is it's a statute that concerns itself with ascertaining the truth, which is, of course, as this court knows, that the entire purpose of a trial is ascertaining the truth. There are certain facts about this case that I've been mentioning before we get into the meat of the particular ordinances or the particular statutes again. This is a particular case where at the deposition the witness admitted under oath that he had reviewed these documents and that these documents had in fact refreshed his recollection. He even confirmed that he reviewed the documents in order to get the facts straight in his mind in order to testify to them. He confirmed that in a later declaration in response to a motion to compel, again confirming that they had refreshed his recollection. Interestingly, after that motion to compel was granted and he was ordered to produce the documents, he then executed an errata sheet under the penalties of perjury where he struck out the words yes in response to questions had he refreshed his recollection with these documents and wrote in the word no. That is exactly why the importance of NRS 50.125 is at issue in a case like this. We have a witness who has admitted under oath that he used the documents to refresh his recollection. Having made that admission and the court ordered their production, he then completely rewrote his testimony, striking the word yes from his deposition transcript and putting the word no in its place. What would be a little hard-pressed, I think, find a more compelling circumstance where a witness's credibility is strongly at issue and should be subject to challenge by examining these documents. Interestingly, also an additional fact I think bears mentioning is when the Discovery Commissioner had ordered the redacted documents produced, and they were produced, it became crystal clear, I think, that this was, as we have characterized it, largely scripted testimony from the witness. If you look at the appendix at the document 82 and on, this is an email that specifically states, this is what he claims refreshed his recollection. Statements such as, without the infrastructure, there would be no deal, and KB knew that the budget and schedule is critical to components of any deal moving forward. All sorts of affirmative statements that then this witness is using as the basis for his testimony. And that is why both Judge Denton originally, the Discovery Commissioner thereafter, and Judge Gonzalez thereafter ordered the production of this information. This is a witness who is using this, what we have characterized as a script. I know that they don't like that characterization, but we view this as largely a scripted testimony from a witness. Now, let's turn to how the statutes operate in circumstances like this. The federal statute does make a distinction between when the witness is on the stand in the presence of the finder of fact and when they are not on the stand in the presence of the finder of fact. The Nevada statute doesn't draw that distinction, and I don't think that that could be just sort of brushed aside as some inadvertence on the part of the Nevada legislature. The federal statute was amended in 1974. The Nevada statute was adopted originally in 1971. In the 40 years since, the Nevada legislature has not seen fit to amend the Nevada statute to add this sort of exception that the plaintiff here is asking you to graft into the Nevada statute about documents used to refresh recollection when the witness is not actually on the stand. But let's deal with this for just a minute about the question, the overall question, is privilege an exception to NRS 50.125? The answer to that has to be no. As a general proposition, it has to be no. Because if it's not no, as I said to you last week, let's remember, the privileges in Chapter 49 are quite extensive. Attorney-client privilege, I know we lawyers are quick to point out the importance of the attorney-client privilege and that, you know, the important societal role that we play in the system. But the reality is, of course, every group in Chapter 49 that has a privilege, as I indicated to you last time, counselors, clergy, marital privileges, they all claim the importance of those privileges. Those privileges, you can see where this heads. If privilege communications are exempt from disclosure when a witness is using them, let's deal with the scenario where they're on the stand, because that's the easiest one for right now. You can just see where this quickly spirals out to. You basically have a witness on the stand with that document. They're using that to testify. Is there any court that would say that is not required to be disclosed so that the veracity of the witness's testimony can be challenged? As I said, we were here last time. Think about the confrontation clause implications for this. We have victims on the witness stand claiming that they changed, you know, their testimony or their recollection has changed since they previously gave a statement. And now they want to alter their testimony, and their defense is, well, my recollection was refreshed by a document that I claim is privileged, so therefore you're not entitled to see it, and you're not entitled to challenge the veracity of my new story. That cannot be. The legislature did not intend that absurdity to occur. And that's why when you look at NRS 50.125, it doesn't start out with except as otherwise provided under Chapter 49. And there are any caveats of any sort. Quite to the contrary, it says in black and white, if the witness uses their writing to refresh his or her memory, which this witness admitted under oath he did, until the order produced and then he changed his testimony, even before or while testifying, an adverse party is entitled to this document. And the reason that you're entitled to the document is because the witness's testimony, the veracity of the witness is at question here. So, again, sticking with the easy scenario, where they're on the stand, and they're using this document to justify either a change in their testimony or to justify, they're basically telling the finder of fact, my story is backed up by this document. When I claim that document refreshed my recollection, you're basically insinuating to the finder of fact, there's support for what I'm telling you, you just can't see it. And that's why the courts, I believe, consistently, even under the federal rules, that's why the federal rule says there's no exception if the witness is on the stand. It's a mandatory disclosure. And the federal courts, I don't believe, have wavered at all on claims of somehow privilege as an exception to that requirement. Where the federal courts have somewhat deviated is in a circumstance where the witness uses the document before testifying to refresh the recollection, and then the federal courts have taken the position, because of the specific wording of Rule 612, the wording which is quite different than what Nevada's provided. Nevada does not distinguish, the statute doesn't distinguish between the witness on the stand or the witness using the document prior to taking the stand or prior to testifying to refresh their recollection. So under those scenarios, I don't believe that there's any appropriate basis for this court to now graft an amendment into NRS 50.125 under the guise of judicial interpretation, because if the legislature had intended to create that exception, the federal rule has been in existence now since 1974 on that, and at no point in time has the legislature seen fit to adopt it. But then I would submit to the court, even if this court were to say, let's just apply the federal rule. Let's disregard the exact wording of our statute and let's apply the federal rule. Under the circumstances of this case, we have three different judges look at this matter and concluded that the documents need to be produced. And there's a lot of basis for all of us to understand why that is the case. The documents, the ones that we have seen, are clearly affirmative statements that this witness is using by which to advocate his position from. The witness changed his sworn testimony once the district court ordered the production of the documents. There are a lot of reasons to understand why the district courts would conclude, under the facts and circumstances of this case, they should be produced. And again, Justice Nicholas, coming back to one of your questions, in this particular case, we had the discovery commissioner look at the documents in camera to discern. You know, we've heard the argument, our mental impressions and the importance of all that. I'm not quarreling with the importance of any privilege. The attorney-client, the work product, the patient-client, the accountant-client. I'm not quarreling that all of those privileges serve a valuable societal purpose. But this court has long ago said that privileges are an obstacle to the truth, and so therefore they are narrowly construed. And doubts about their application are resolved in favor of disclosure, not in favor of concealment. When you consider the limited purpose of the privilege and what is transpiring in this case, I think it's quite reasonable to understand why both Judge Denton, Judge Gonzalez, and the Discovery Commissioner came to the conclusion that they did. The Discovery Commissioner looked at these documents, determined that there was no way to somehow say that certain information in it could be separated out as somehow opinion or highly protected work product or anything of that sort. After conducting her in-camera examination, she concluded that the entirety of the documents needed to be produced. And under the circumstances of this case, I don't believe anyone can say on this record that she or the district judge, the two district judges that looked at this, somehow abused their discretion in that regard.
Mr. Bice, I just have one question on the timing on the case here. My understanding is the deposition of the witness was on May 1st and May 2nd of 2012.
Right.
The motion to compel was filed June 1st. I assume you're waiting to get the transcript and all from the deposition to attach that to the motion to compel.
That is what we were doing, Justice Gibbons, and the district court, the Discovery Commissioner had ruled that we were entitled to continue the deposition on the basis of the documents being ordered to produce.
Okay.
So again, this is a little bit different than some of the arguments that were being made in front of you last week, that the witness is off the stand and the witness's veracity is no longer subject to any form of challenge. That certainly is not the case here. We don't have the timing issue that we had last week.
Right.
And I know you gave me additional time, but I believe I've addressed what I wanted to say. If the court doesn't have questions for me.
I had one question. I felt when I told Mr. Well about the hearing last week, which obviously you were there and you argued it.
Yes.
Would you have any objection if the court clerk told Mr. Morris that we had the argument today on a similar issue?
Absolutely not. And you know, I know Mr. Morris myself. I'd be happy to inform him of it as well.
Perhaps you could do it. Keep us out in the middle of it.
I will alert Mr. Morris today that we had this argument. I'll give him the case number and so advise him.
We appreciate that very much. Thank you very much.
I thank the court for his time.
Okay, Mr. Wall.
Thank you, Your Honors. If you look at our reply on pages 13 and 14, you will see the decision, the basis that Judge Commissioner Boulon gave for her decision, and it was not that she felt like she was going to she was going to have some discovery and some not. She reached the conclusion that it's an absolute statute, and I expected to hear opposing counsel argue exactly what he said, that the statute is absolute because it doesn't have any language in it. We have to concede there's no language in NRS 50.125 that has exceptions. It's because it's a general statute. That fact alone should not lead to the conclusion that the statute was intended to abrogate our privilege. It simply wasn't intended for that. It does not express
Why don't we talk about, I think Justice Douglas maybe was alluding to this too, about statutory construction. This is one of many cases where you have this gray area here. Each side has a different interpretation of the intent of the statute. Tell us why under statutory construction that we should interpret the way you suggest.
And the statutes, they have to be considered together in order to reach that policy decision that needs to be made. And that policy decision can't be that privilege is always waived. That is just a wrong decision. It means it's a trap for the lawyer. It's something that now has to be taught to all the lawyers. that you know, you have to be very careful about what you can talk about it, but you can't write it down, you can't show it to somebody. Counsel talked about privilege should be narrowly construed, and we agree with that. The point is, we're not here to construe privilege, because that's not the issue before this court. Privilege has already been construed by the district court. That hasn't been challenged here, and that's not the issue. Once a privilege has been found to exist, as in this case, then you have to determine whether or not it's been waived. That's the issue. So most of what counsel said about the purposes of a trial, for ascertaining the truth, discovery, so that we can challenge credibility, etc. That's, of course, that's true. But the privilege always works against that, regardless of the context that we're in. And it certainly works that way in this context. And there's no indication that the legislature didn't know or anticipate that privilege, this privilege and other privileges and other rules of evidence might impact upon this statute. They simply didn't address those in this statute. They addressed those in the privilege statute. That's where those were addressed. He talked about the credibility of the witness, and he read some statements where she said were affirmative statements of fact. The reason he's able to read those things is because those have been produced. The factual material has been produced. But why does he need the mental impressions of counsel, the legal strategies and the opinions for a strategy or to test the credibility of the witness? He doesn't. That's the part of the document that is protectable and should be protected and wasn't protected.
Thank you very much. Thank you both of you, as always, for your excellent arguments and briefs, and the case was now submitted at this time.